Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back. You're with Greenwashed. I'm Jaspreet here with Don Nicholson. And today we're trying to broaden the discussion about productivity and efficiency to more than just, you know, farming, as Don and I usually want to. So in line with that, we have two engineers in the house today. We have a guest who's been here in the past, John Scarry, structural engineer back with us, as well as a new face. We have Duncan Campbell, who is a traffic engineer, along with John here, who will be holding fort. So welcome, gentlemen. Don and I are very happy to have you on Greenwashed. And Duncan, if we could begin with you, if you could give our listeners a bit of a background.
Yeah, hello. I'm a civil engineer, traffic engineer. I graduated in 91 with a civil engineering degree. I tried to escape it briefly at the time, but there was a recession back in 91, and it ended up falling into transport traffic engineering and getting a job at Auckland City doing traffic and transportation, and ended up working in that field for the next 25 years or so, consultants in various councils, mostly Auckland. And I migrated to Taupo in 2016. I've been here since. That actually works quite well here because the traffic engineering is really a city job, and I wouldn't be able to do it without Google Street View, to be honest, to live in a provincial place. But while I'm here, I got interested in local politics, and which I never had before living in Auckland. But I managed to scrape in as an elected councillor for Taupo District Council in 2022, and that's been interesting.
Excellent. And have you been enjoying the role in council, Duncan? How's it been?
It's been very, very good. I found it really interesting experience. Certainly different from engineering, just sort of getting involved in the detail and the nuts and bolts. It's a lot more people stuff, which engineering often isn't. So I've enjoyed it.
Yeah, excellent. And John, welcome. You've been here before, but we'd love a background again, please, if possible.
I'm a structural engineer, and I've been working for about 41 years now. And over the years, I've campaigned to try to address serious problems in structural engineering and the wider building and construction industry.
Yes.
And while that's great to have you too. Sorry, John, carry on.
Well, I was just going to give you an update from the last full interview you gave me, where I was looking at how woke has come into engineering and net zero agenda. So whether you like it or not, I thought I'd just update you what's happening in the Structural Engineering Society.
Well, you beat me to it.
When we last spoke, I said how I was being censored when I tried to address the issue of net carbon zero coming into structural engineering. Well, the censorship has now increased to the point where I'm censored on what are purely technical and practice issues when I'm trying to call truth to power, and I'm censored on that now. But whereas the woke stuff we talked about a year ago was up at Engineering New Zealand level, it's now come down fully to the Structural Engineering Society. Not so much in day-to-day structural practice, but the warning bells are there. And since I was that interview, Communist China would have brought on about 70 new coal-fired power stations the size of Huntley. Well, the latest monthly bulletin from the Structural Engineering Society has CSOC top tips for low carbon design to be expected for a country called Aotearoa, New Zealand. But you have Engineers for Social Responsibility with their roadmap to net carbon zero for Aotearoa, New Zealand's concrete industry, because apparently New Zealand's leading the world in the push to net zero concrete, and climate change and the economy of Aotearoa. But other things that have come along, we now have Advancing Women in Engineering and Construction, where they get to share their experiences, challenges, and vision for a more inclusive future engineering, so that the pathways to success are equitable. There was a diversity agenda summit where 200 women gathered to talk about their experiences. And there's a push now that in CSOC, the goal will be shifting representation in our leadership groups to 40-40-20, women, men, any gender. Now, I don't know whether any gender means it can be men or woman, or it's to accommodate the 70 other genders that the United Nations recognises. But there's a co-facilitated signature program, Mobilise, first of its kind in Aotearoa, New Zealand, specially designed for men. It brings men together to cultivate their inclusive leadership presence, learn the art of allyship, and mobilise a community of inclusive leaders to break down systems of bias and share power with others.
Wow.
Now, as far as sharing power, my power as a male engineer, I would first of all like someone to give me some power so I could then fight attempts to make me share it. Then a new strategy to embed Te Ao Māori in the engineering profession. Now, Te Ao Māori has no place in structural engineering in this country in the same way as Gaelic has no place in the exercise of structural engineering in Ireland. The simple fact is engineering is done in English, and it has to be done in English because even with the precision of the terms we're used to dealing with, there's confusion. If you tried to do it in Maori or another language, it would be a nightmare. And then there's also an inclusion research project between various universities, and it's to understand how to retain women and other marginalised groups in the engineering industry. It's a five-year study examining the sense of belonging, satisfaction, cultural well-being, and perceptions of future career over time.
Oh, gosh. I take that. I mean, how patronizing is that, calling women marginalized? But, you know, one would wonder they should be more worried about other stuff that's happening, like the maintenance crews that removed all the nuts at the bottom of the three legs of the power pylon that collapsed in Northland not long ago, leaving 100,000 without power. I wonder, in all of this, where is the efficiency that is needed? Engineering should be colorblind, should be gender neutral, should be completely focused on delivering excellence in outcomes. And yet, here we are, just going more and more down this agenda. And Duncan, I see you shaking your head. What are your thoughts on this?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I was just occurring to me that in the realm of transportation, my realm, which I've been involved in, sort of ideologies and things have always been part of engineering. It's I've got to say, from my perspective, as far as I can tell, transport, transport engineering is really a mix of science and politics and ideology, and it's always been that way. And I suppose net zero is, and all this other stuff is the latest thing to come along. I mean, if you look back just to the 1950s and 60s. In the United States, I mean, there was an ideology to blast through freeways and highways for the motor car, the golden age of the motor car, and they had their reasons to do that, and it was an ideology, a lot of it was ideological, and the devastation and destruction to a lot of towns and cities.
Mm.
It's, some of us, for example, that the smart city, the 15-minute city, 15-minute town thing, as far as I can make out, was started off back in the 1960s as a reaction to some of that car-centric ideology, and it goes on.
Yeah, and those of us that have travelled into the bigger countries around the world, even smaller ones, European or American or Australian, they did just seem to move mountains to make things better, build tunnels, move mountains, and make massive corridors for effectively commercial activity and private activity. And it worked. It worked. Why do we dislike it so much? Why is there such a negativity towards this, let's build better roads? I mean, I've got a view and a friend, it's not my idea, but I'm going to buy it. New Zealand needs a 4-lane highway from Whangarei to Invercargill. and two lanes each way. Open the country up. Be best thing that could ever happen.
That sort of stuff is generally plainly good. I mean, it costs a bit, but it's plainly good. But I suppose the argument, I think these things were taken a bit more to a bit more extremes in the United States, where you still have towns, small cities, where it's actually safer and easier to get in your car to drive half to get to the shop half a mile away, because it's literally there's no sidewalks, and it's been designed for them. I mean, there are places like that. There's not many like that in New Zealand I can think of. So I mean, there are valid reasons for some of that pushback. We don't see it so clearly here, I think.
So going back to you, John, for a moment, you talked about the DEI stuff coming down the line and into the structural engineering organization. Is that a mirror image of what's at Engineering New Zealand? Because I've just got on my screen in front of me the Engineering New Zealand merging their resource with Architecture New Zealand, or New Zealand Architects. 22,000 members of Engineering New Zealand, 4,000 members of the architects organizations, and the diversity agenda. And it talks about engineering and architecture for everyone. And of course, it's got a lot of programs if you want to be part of it. They've even got their champions, they've got their signatories. You see their people on one of their cover pages. I mean, it's all, forget about necessarily. We just pre-talked about it, colorblind, gender blind, everything should be blind, but gee, this is everything, but it seems to be the opposite. So is your CSOC organization got the similar mirror image of what's at Engineering New Zealand?
Well, yes, those agendas have filtered down to what should be a technical society. You could argue that because Engineering New Zealand kept the engineering practice and so-called ethics, that's where the DEI would come in. But apart from the net zero stuff, which is starting to have some serious consequences, through the H1 requirements for insulation, which is leading to some ludicrous foundation designs. My condemnation of this DEI nonsense at CSOC and at Engineering New Zealand is that they are wasting their time on that when they need to be addressing real issues. I don't know when you are going to have issues of, companies being forced to have so many people of this persuasion and so many people of that. But we have very serious problems in building and construction in New Zealand, and they are not paying attention to it. Last year, the beginning of last year, Engineering New Zealand brought out a report where they, over several years, they, I think, paid engineers to review 20 warehouse building designs. Now, warehouses are just big industrial boxes of different types. They should be about the simplest building to do on a commercial basis. Houses aren't simple, they tend to be complicated, but a big box or simple warehouse type operations should be the simplest building. Their findings were, it was poorly presented, but depending on how you read it, it meant that of those 20 designs, nearly all of one which were done since I wrote my open letter of 2002, as few as 20%, and at most 60%, were code compliant. So on the simplest type of commercial building, on a random sample big enough to be make sense, at least 40% of the designs were not code compliant. And then Engineering New Zealand put out a sort of discussion document that noted some problems in structural engineering, but their solution basically was that all of the parties that have got us where we are today will carry on doing what they're doing in the same way, and everything will be wonderful, which doesn't make sense. So
Oh,
instead
sounds
of worrying,
outrageous.
I mean, it is absolutely outrageous. And this thing about diversity, well, it's a woman migrant engineer who found a whole cluster of bad designs, which actually led ultimately to that scientific study. So, I mean, The problem isn't that we don't have enough women engineers or we have too many women engineers. The problem is we have good ones who are struggling with the nonsense they are confronted with, and we have other ones who are probably churning out rubbish, maybe in a company that's not providing with proper training. That's what the engineering is supposed to be about. And if you go back to the pylon collapse, in the 90s, I did some work in the electricity industry to do with hydro dams and communication equipment. So we were putting up small and large poles and towers. The work was tendered and it went to a company, and the foreman for the work was a Maori man who'd worked at NZED, and in his career he had assembled 900 power pylons. Now, he wouldn't have gone along to a tower and taken all the nuts off three legs for it to fall over. We had diversity, but we had competence. And the key thing there is he had the job. He probably had a Maori apprenticeship, but he had the job through his competence and experience. And he did his job well.
Mm. Yeah.
Now, and what's your experience in that sort of same sort of paradigm, Duncan?
Well, to be honest, I haven't got any direct experience of that effect, that sort of diversity stuff affecting me, not in the last while, because I've worked independently for the last 10 years and haven't been part of a working in councils. But or
do you feel, Duncan, that it is still pure engineering? Because if I look at the Taupo District's transport plan, this is before your time, 2020, they had the 2020 to 2050 transport plan. Everything it began with saying for Taupo, we need safety as a top priority. We have to transition to a low emission transport. We have an aging population, so we need more pedestrian crossings, more footpaths. And car-centric transport networks have delivered poor horizontal working and cycling connections that traverse hills, so on and so forth. None of that. I just wonder what sort of bang for the buck, because you see this coming through different ways into different areas. Do you think people today, for our transport, do we think we get the ratepayers, the taxpayers, get the best bang for the buck?
Oh, well, not here. No, they don't. No. That's actually one of my sort of burning issues, actually. Bang for buck infrastructure. Because you can spend a heck of a lot of money on a concrete raised platform for pedestrians to make it not, well, Auckland, you hear it, the headlines from Auckland when they can do, I mean, you can spend a heck of a lot, the thing about transport and roads is you can spend a heck of a lot of money on stuff and not achieve very much.
You can spend tens of thousands on just changing the name on a sign, or someone's got offended, you put something there or add something there. But when you have the country's biggest international, Air New Zealand, God, get it together, Jaspreet. When you have Air New Zealand dumping its targets, 2030 emission targets, we are still expecting councils and, you know, this everyone else, even farmers, to just keep going along and somehow transition to a low emissions economy. I don't get that. And somehow, for me, roading should just be getting from A to B.
Oh, yes, but as I was saying, transport has always been had some ideology of some sort or another going on, and this is well below, before this net zero stuff. I mean, say in the 90s, say it was legitimate drive to improve public transport and cycling and walking in cities like Auckland, because basically left to their own devices. I mean, people are not like ants and will all work communally and figure out a common greater
goal,
way forward. We all just want to get into our motor cars and drive individually to get to work. Well, I mean, sooner or later, it all grinds to a halt. So there has to be an adult in the room to come and say, well, hey, no, actually, sorry. We've got to do things differently. We're going to actually put some bus lanes in and get a public transport network for you. Okay, you might not want to use it, but sorry, it's not working for everyone. We're going to make it happen for you. And I'll tell you, there's a lot of, in the area of transport and transport planners, you get a lot of socialist-minded people, because it actually is the only way to sort of get things happening and working.
But at the same point, we've seen some of the biggest projects like Let's Get Wellington Moving not even get off, and yet retailers on the main drags of some of our biggest cities, or even the smaller ones, are losing out revenue because they want cycle lanes everywhere. So at what point do we draw a line and say, hey, this doesn't add up now?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. I've seen this so much. The balance just doesn't seem to be in there. An ideology, a fad sets in. Cycle lanes. Okay, we've got to put cycle lanes everywhere. So we just thump them everywhere to the detriment a lot of other good stuff. And the last government was throwing a lot of money at cycleways. I mean, I used to bike from West Auckland to the CBD. And it was a great way to get to town. And if you live in Auckland, I think, and if you want to bike somewhere, live out in West Auckland, but near the motorway anyway, because there's great facilities out there. But the thinking that it then morphed into something that, well, we've got to spend money on protecting them everywhere, and we've got to get them away from car traffic all the time. And
because
it costs a heck of a lot of money to do that. It's not affordable. It's not.
Because it didn't just stop there. If it just cycle lanes, I wouldn't mind. But then you have everything else being coerced. You have telling developers, please don't put parkings in houses so people don't get. Then you have these high density apartments where, of course, you again possibly can't afford that. And that's why you're going into those apartments where trying to raise a family there. Then there is now talking of congestion charging in some of our bigger cities. So the agenda just doesn't stop there, does it? They don't just want that. You know, short of just issuing bicycles to everyone and confiscating cars, there's not a lot this lot have not tried.
Oh, yeah, well, I don't know if you realise it. I hadn't quite realised it before, but this new regime of no parking required for any new development, which the Labor government brought in, that's actually I hadn't realised it. It's actually a world first.
Wow.
No. It's pretty. It's telling you what, we're leading edge, New Zealand. We're leading the way. I mean, there are some merits to it, but I think the disadvantages to it will come out in the wash. I don't think they've fully come out in the wash yet. And that thing about congestion charging, we don't have it here yet. Mm-hmm. But and again, this is one of those political things, because it could be described as paving the roads clear for the rich to afford to get to use their cars. I mean, I've absolutely heard it described as that in countries where it is. it's a blunt instrument, all right.
Fabulous. I mean, I look in our city, Jasprit, and there's cycle lanes everywhere, and I hardly ever see a cycle on them. They're barren. There's no kids biking home from school because the cars are outside the school knee deep picking up the kids. There's a few buses, of course, but those cycle lanes that are everywhere around Invercargill, a city of 50,000 people, not being used, and it's a flat city. It's amazing. Yeah, what I have seen on it, though, is e-bikes with middle-aged people on, zooming along, and you actually you have to be very careful of those people because they're going a lot quicker than the standard cycle. Anyway, John, what's your experience in this? You've always got a wide view on a lot of things, so I'd love to have your opinion on that. What are you thinking on that?
Well, being a real Aucklander who was born at National Women's and have lived here most of my life, my take on it is that in the 1970s and 80s, partly through perhaps commercial reasons, but to me the planning in Auckland was to force people to have to travel further and further for the basic necessities of life. It used to be that you could go to your local shopping centre and get most things there, and you could walk. You could also, even in a wealthy suburb like Remuera, nearly all the kids walked and cycled to school. And an area like Panmure had a wide array of different types of shops, furniture, clothing, etc. And a lot of suburbs around, people would go there and shop. They've closed down so many of these areas. They've moved industry further away. They've set up these massive malls, which you have to travel many kilometres to. Schools have been put in a long way away from the houses. They've closed down or not allowed for local dairies. Or the other thing was a lot of local garages would have a little workshop where you could get your car fixed. They were closed down as well. I mean, I'm aware of a dilapidated old house come dairy in Christchurch. And my understanding is when that building is demolished, there will not be allowed to be a dairy sitting on the corner of some suburban streets. What is wrong with the classic corner dairy? So it's sort of, if there is a, it's either gross incompetence where they go along one path with locking in something that can't be turned around without the slightest thought, or it's this other tactic of pushing you for two different directions. They spread you out and then you are punished because you have to travel. And again, planning isn't just about planners sitting down with their latest dreams of how they make all the yucky stuff over here and the nice stuff over here and the different stuff over here. How can you have an immigration policy and economic policies which has vast numbers of essentially consumers coming to Auckland and being plonked in? Again, proper planning, if the plan was to massively increase Auckland's population back in the 90s, well, in the 80s, they shouldn't have sold these corridors that we had for future infrastructure development. And surely it would be like planning new comprehensive areas heading up to the northwest on the old desiccated gum lands, instead of just mindless sprawl over our market gardens and rolling farmland of South Auckland. Again, it gets back to this total planning. And again, I would, you know, it's just another example where the dominance of what I would call finance and money and theory over practicality. When the Ministry of Works was deliberately destroyed in the 1980s, because it was a competitor to Treasury and what they were implementing, the Ministry of Works had a very large economic role, but they had a critical role in monitoring local body infrastructure to make sure, and that was at a time when the local bodies basically existed only to provide local infrastructure. They had a mayor who would meet foreign dignitaries, but it was all about infrastructure. And the Ministry of Works kept an oversight on it. And yet one of the reasons that we had the three waters pushed on us was that half the local authorities had lagged well behind. Well, the Ministry of Works wouldn't have allowed that to happen.
Right. And I sort of agree, John, that the core business of local government was exactly as you describe it once upon a time. And now they're spraying themselves into a very wide range of you know, non-jobs, really, or sort of stuff that's not core. And it comes at great cost to the infrastructure that should be looked after. And trying to get that through to a local council hierarchy just seems to be close to impossible. You know, was it the power of general competence in 2002 that gave rise to this sort of do what you like attitude at local authority level? I mean, I remember former Mayor Sir Tim Shadbolt in Invercargill saying, good, I can do what I like now, basically, to
what?
Us. And so we can own what we like, we can do what we like. And, you know, within the bounds of sensibility, a lot of things have happened since that are outrageous. Outrageous. They didn't, you know, and finally they did, in Invercargill sense, they did realize that their water infrastructure, wastewater infrastructure, was seriously deficient. And there's about $100 million repair job going on right now, and it'll take many years. But that was the attitude in the governing class, perhaps the leftist governing class of 2002.
So they got free rein, you're saying, Don?
Oh, that's what that's what it seemed to me.
Anything and everything would come in their ambit.
Yeah.
Oh, can I jump in there?
Yeah.
No, if you look in the Local Government Act, and I haven't got in front of me right here, but the purpose of local government, and there's only two little points there. The second point there, I believe it was added some time ago, maybe in that realm, around that era. But one of the purposes of local government is to look out for future generations and basically do stuff for them. So yes. If you want an open excuse to do anything you want because you believe it's better for future generations. Well, that's it.
Intergenerational equity, it was called,
I'll spell it out. It says the purpose of local government is to promote the social, economic, environmental, and cultural well-being of communities in the present and for the future. Now, this precious little that you can't massage into fitting that.
Oh, anything. Save the world. Yeah. We've got to save the world. Yeah. Everything. Anything and everything.
Yeah.
Yes, but sorry, who's going to save the world at the local level? Mm. When I looked at the Local Government Act, it says in the preamble that its purpose is to enhance local democracy or something like that. So, and maybe I can't read an act, but when I looked for a defined role of councillors, it isn't there. And when I look for a defined power for the councillors, it's not there. The people, whether they're the ratepayers or the people who pay rent to the ratepayers or whatever, they own the local area. Their representatives are the councillors, and the councillors should be in control. But apparently, they are supposed to be mushrooms, and the person who opens the door and throws in the stuff for them to grow in, if they feel like it, is the chief executive, who is unaccountable. And, you know, throughout private industry and everything else, isn't the board, you know, the representatives of the owners, they are there to govern. And yet the councillors cannot get involved, even in a crisis, in what are called operational matters. What matters? Well, if you know something's going on with building consents or traffic jams or dodgy contracts, if a knowledgeable and interested councillor cannot look into it, there is no governance at all.
Yep, they are hamstrung. There is a certain way these things have to move.
I have no representation.
But the strange thing to me, sorry, I need to jump in there and a bit of an opinion here rather than getting... I'm giving Jaspreet the say here. Isn't it interesting? I observed, Jaspreet, that when you became a councillor a couple of years ago, the first thing they do is take you away to a retreat to have they call it an induction rather than introduction. And it staggers me that you're not allowed to have freedom of thought before you've actually got the indoctrination machine coming at you by your CEO, actually, the very person you employ. Is that how it's been for perhaps you, Duncan, in the Taupo zone when you became a councillor? Did you get inducted into the business?
Oh, absolutely. No, yeah. Full immersion treatment. I wouldn't just call it brainwashing, but certainly encouraged all the way along, and I call it this operational / governance ideology, which means you are in governance now. Don't you dare start getting involved in the detail. That's for the staff. And I suppose for me, coming from a city, as I happen to be in transport, coming to a provincial place, and me with my eyes believing I can see, okay, I don't really want to get involved in the detail, but I'm actually, I recognize some poor outcomes that some of you aren't. Well, that's a spanner in the works.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, there's a concern. I have some sympathy in some ways to counter my assertion that you do get ratepayers with bright ideas and even crazy ideas, and some people are fringe, you know, with their ideas, and you've got to be able to sift it out. And perhaps that's best done at the CEO and management level before it gets to your level as councillors. I don't know. There's a double-edged sword here.
It is, and you have to, I think, be your own person, speak your own mind, and not allow yourself to be, because it's hard to be sometimes the one person who seems to be pretty much against everything. And it is hard, because ultimately decisions are made by consensus. But I guess at the end of it, just like in whatever other job you might be, you have to be true to yourself. You have to say what you feel is right, and let the vote fall where it may.
Yeah, I haven't seen any training courses in doing this, as in being an effective local politician. But there's no Local Government New Zealand course on that I'm aware of, which actually does that. It's
no, they all the courses seem to be for the staff. Not for the counselors, yeah.
Yeah,
LGNs and trainings and all of those.
So coming right on back to where we started almost, what benefit has been delivered for the cost of the ESG, environmental social governance regimes, the stakeholder gains as, you know, yeah, what's and the DEI programs? What usefulness has really come out of all this stuff? I mean, I look at the going back to the engineering fraternities for a moment. I look at the pictures of all the people that are in this DEI group. They look reasonable people. There's a steering committee. There's a couple of people employed. There's a whole lot of other people as their sort of champions within the workplace. I mean, they all seem really, really decent people. So why? My question is, why do we even need this stuff when decent people do the right thing in general? I don't see any gain for all this, just cost and just diverting people from the job they're employed to do, which is put out good engineering or good architecture. I just, as a layman, I'm struggling to understand the benefit here. John, what's your opinion in the end? We'll sum up in the next few minutes, by the way, chaps.
Well, there's no benefit and it is stupid. I think it's going along with a herd mentality. These people, so many of them might be good engineers, but they lack a wider knowledge to know that it's all just nonsense and irrelevant. But so far, the damage that DEI has caused to me, and I have contempt for it, pales into comparison to the devastation caused to our infrastructure and our skill base by, I'll call them the money men, economists, bureaucrats, etc., who put in policies which have degraded the role of engineers, the skill base of engineers, and just doing ordinary business as usual. You know, it used to be you had the mayor, the town clerk, the town engineer, the infrastructure, things just rolled along. And I think, amongst other things, people looked at all of these massive assets and with dollar signs in their eyes, and they saw it as a cash cow that could maybe be privatized off or could generate money. On the wider scale, we ended up paying for our power system about three times over. And this disgusting thing about road charges, congestion charges, etc., we own the roads. We have paid for them over and over again. So how can they charge us to use our roads? If people want to sit in a traffic jam for 6 hours, it's their right to sit in a traffic jam for 6 hours. We have paid more than enough for it. And the other thing about proper infrastructure, you just keep ticking over. A lot of good infrastructure needs regular maintenance. And what you have is so many of the people put in charge of it, stipend, are rotated through on a three-year basis because instead of councils employing engineers on a long-term basis, it's done by private companies on short-term contracts. So you lose institutional knowledge, etc. And the other important thing, maintenance is super critical. The reason we have so much paved road in New Zealand, the highest in the world, is we had thin, flexible pavements with chip seal. They required regular maintenance, but for many years that maintenance wasn't done. And the important thing also to look at the actual cost of infrastructure. Everything in New Zealand, which is an expenditure on good, is always the gross figure. But if you employ, if central government gives local body $100 million to do some serious infrastructure, so much of that is taken back. Well, all of the GST is taken back immediately, and so much of the expenditure comes back as tax. And if it's done properly and efficiently, we end up with this excellent piece of infrastructure, which either stops us polluting or improves our economic performance or gives us more time. And one of the advantages of cars until we were stuck in massive traffic jams is it gave people freedom and it freed up time and time savings, so we get to enjoy it. So my complaint on the whole thing is The fundamental thing has to be competent people, well planned to do the infrastructure consistently. It shouldn't be the latest thing to win votes or whatever. Actual cost needs to be considered, and there needs to be proper oversight. So just another reason for re-establishing a Ministry of Building and Construction or something like it.
So, Duncan, just your final thoughts. What would be the recipe for the best for New Zealand in terms of, for instance, the transport infrastructure, and the road rules and all that sort of stuff? What would you?
Oh, well, I agree with you on this. Other stuff is sort of unnecessary distractions from real problems. But the best solution for transport? Well, goodness, yeah. What's going to be the next ideology which takes over after this one? It's sort of waiting for it. But I'll just throw in something of interest. I thought was of interest. Like some years ago, up till about 2010 or so, NZTA used to let out have available funds for research funding that anyone could apply for, and come up with your ideas and submit them to NZTA. And there'd be a panel at NZTA who would go through them, and it could be all sorts of ideas, left field, right field, whatever. I was part of some of those successful bids, and it was intriguing and interesting, and it would sort of add some fresh ideas into the mix. But since around about 2010, they sort of closed that down, and it's like NZTA decided that they were the font of knowledge. We'll tell you what we want to be researched. Thank you very much. I mean, there might be exceptions out there. I haven't exactly kept track. But for example, is there a funded research paper into investigating the viability of net zero for transport? Is there a research study out there on that? I haven't heard of it. So it's like the government, the NZTA, have decided that they know better, and yeah.
But what I can tell you, Duncan, is that NZTA does have a study on collaborating with the Pacifica, Wahine, Pride, Neurodiversity and other employee-led networks to investigate the gender pay gap further.
Well, there you go.
fundamental stuff, wasn't it? Fundamental.
Yeah.
Gosh. Well, gentlemen, you've done... I know it's once over lightly, but you've got some seriously serious concerns for the fields you're working among. And, I think it's only right that Reality Check Radio highlights these for people like you who perhaps don't have the wider audience. So, anything more we can do to help, we're here to help. So thanks for having you on RCR Greenwashed again today.
All right.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Duncan.
Are you loving what you're hearing? Well, the establishment hates it, and right now they're conjuring up new ways to try and censor RCR. To ensure you never miss a beat of the hard-hitting news you've come to know and love, make sure you're on the RCR mailing list. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.